Welcome, everyone. I'm Meir Soloveitchik, rabbi of Congregation Sheretz Israel and director of the Zahavan Moshe Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought at Yeshiva University. I'm very, very delighted to welcome you all to our book launch event for the Megillat Esther Mesorat HaRav, a commentary based on the teachings of Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. For the many who have asked, I will not be signing the books today. However, I do have a son named Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, and he would be happy to sign it for $10 a person. So make checks payable to Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. I just want to recognize a couple of people. The president of Sheretz Israel, Lou Solomon, Moshe Strauss, my partner in the vision that is the Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought, Rabbi Menachem Ganak of the Orthodox Union, and Erwin Shapiro, who has just arrived, sponsor of the book, and has done such incredible work to bring the Torah of Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal to an even wider audience. I'd like to now call on Rabbi Moshe Ganak, the editor of this wonderful new volume, to give introductory words. Rabbi Ganak.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us at the book launch for Megillas Esther Mesoras HaRav. My name is Moshe Ganak, and I was one of the co-editors for this volume, and I am speaking on behalf of OU Press. There are many people and organizations that deserve Hakaras HaTov for making this sefer a reality, and we'll get to all of them. My father, Rabbi Menachem Ganak, the general editor of OU Press, presented the idea to me a couple years ago to take on this project, to co-edit a sefer of Rav Soloveitchik's commentary on Megillas Esther. I was hesitant at first. I enjoy writing, but had never edited a published volume. My father argued that it would be a worthwhile project, and I'll get to learn the Rav's Torah during the process. I'm very happy that I acquiesced, and I thank him for his encouragement. OU Press has done the Jewish intellectual community a great service by providing them with high-quality svarim in Hebrew and English that enlighten and inspire their readership. They have placed a specific focus on the teachings of the Rav, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. Koren served as the publisher of this volume, and like their other works, this sefer is easy to read and aesthetically appealing to the eye. We also thank them for co-sponsoring this event, and a special thank you to Matthew Miller, the publisher of Koren. I'd like to recognize those who took an active role in putting together the commentary and reshimot for this sefer. Dr. Joel Walwalski compiled the majority of the commentary for the Megillah. Additionally, Rabbi Eliyahu Krakowski, the associate editor of OU Press, along with Rabbi Simon Posner, the executive editor of OU Press, went over the manuscript meticulously to produce this volume. Simon is unfortunately not able to be here tonight due to a prior commitment, but very much wanted to be here. We also want to recognize Rabbi Julius Berman, the chairman of the OU Press Commission, for everything he's done for OU Press. This sefer has basically sold out in the United States and was one of the best sellers at the YU Svarim sale. So the books you see outside are the last ones to go. I also want to take a moment to recognize and sincerely thank those who generously sponsored this sefer. We are grateful to the Stone family, to Erwin and Ruth Shapiro, to Yitzchak and Barbie Lehman Siegel and family, to Baruch and Susie Singer and family, to the extended Singer family, to Mark and Chava Finkel, to Tim and Ria Levart, to Steve and Pesh Katz, to Daniel and Joyce Strauss, and to Moshe and Zahava Strauss. Thank you very much for sponsoring this launch. This launch is also sponsored by Yeshiva University's Zahava and Moshe Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought, of which Rabbi Soloveitchik is the director, and is in the midst of an international speaking tour about whether Alexander Hamilton was Jewish. It would be nice to have him as part of the
trip. Spoiler alert, yes.
There you go. Was he a Litvak, though? That we don't know. Okay.
Not in Sherith Israel.
Not Sherith Israel. Publishing a sefer from Rabbi Soloveitchik on Purim has special significance. As my father writes in the preface of the book, for the Rav, the holiday of Purim and the story of the Megillah represents the way that God often interacts with the Jewish people. On one hand, he is hidden, but when one scratches beneath the surface, it is clear that it is the Almighty behind the scenes. God's name is not mentioned in Megillas Esther. In fact, the Gemara says that the biblical source for the name Esther is a verse in Sefer Devarim, Vanochi Haster Aster Aspanav, that God conceals his face. Yet the Midrash tells us that when the Megillah says HaMelech, which seems to refer to Ahasuerus, it really is also a reference to God, who is secretly coordinating the events taking place. We see this as well in the well-known Zohar, which says that Yom HaKippurim, the Day of Atonement, is Kippurim, is like Purim. How is Purim, a day to eat, drink, and be merry, similar to Yom Kippur, a day of fasting and repentance? The Rav suggested that the underlying theme of both days is the same. Each revolves around a lottery. Purim is a lottery of the wicked Haman when he considered the right day to wipe out the Jews. And Yom Kippur is the lottery of the Seir LaHashem and the Seir LaHazazel. Although these lotteries seem random, our eternal belief in God tells us that it is in fact him who is coordinating the events taking place. A couple months ago, Rabbi Soloveitchik was invited to the White House to light the menorah at the White House annual Hanukkah party. And when President Trump was introducing the rabbi, he had a little difficulty pronouncing his last name. If I were president, I would have no difficulty pronouncing your last name. Just yesterday, in a Gemara shir I gave, I quoted the Rav's uncle, Rav Velvel Soloveitchik. And this year before that, I quoted the Rav's grandfather, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. The Soloveitchik family, the Torah and the Mesorah of Beis Brisk, where the Rav grew up, lives in the study halls and in the homes of the Jewish people. With Megillas Esther Mesoras HaRav, we are adding to that legacy. It is my honor to introduce the rabbi of She'eris Israel, Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik.
Thank you very much. Everybody can hear me? Okay. Thank you very much, Rabbi Ganak, for your incredible work, for your very gracious words, and for your flawless pronunciation of my name. Your family and my family share a very, very special bond, and it's wonderful to share this evening together with you. I share with your father, Rabbi Menachem Ganak, as well, beyond the familial bonds and history that we share, a love of America, of American history, and of Abraham Lincoln in particular. And that has informed some of my remarks tonight. The book of Esther was well known to some of the significant statesmen in American history and was quoted and utilized by them in their writings and their rhetoric. Thus, on December 17, 1778, George Washington, who was then a general, the general of the Continental Army, wrote to Joseph Reed, who was the president of Pennsylvania, lamenting war profiteering. And he declared, quote, "I would to God that one of the most atrocious of each state was hung in gibbets upon a gallows five times as high as the one prepared by Haman," end quote. Thomas Jefferson, after the Revolution, wrote in a letter that, quote, "If our country, when pressed with wrongs at the point of the bayonet, had been governed by its head instead of its heart, where should we have been now, hanging on a gallows as high as Haman's?" End quote. But my favorite Megillah-related American quote comes from one of my favorite people in American history, which is Abigail Adams, who I'm lobbying now to be put on the 20 instead of Andrew Jackson, That's going to be my next focus after we conclusively prove Alexander Hamilton's Jewishness. And she was writing a letter to her husband, John Adams, about the hated royalist governor of Massachusetts, Thomas Hutchinson, and she writes as follows, quote, I suppose you will receive, he wrote a memoir, so she wrote to him, to Adams, I suppose you will receive two or three volumes of that forlorn wretch Hutchinson's letters. And then she adds, quote, may the fate of Mordecai be his. The fate of Mordecai? What does this mean? It would seem, ostensibly, that Abigail Adams, in her anger, confused the hero and the villain in this eternal tale and has mixed up Haman and Mordecai. But that is surely a calumny. And obviously, she was merely embodying obedience to the Talmudic dictum, Chayev Inish Livsume Bepuria Adlo Yada Bein Arar Haman LeBaruch Mordechai. One is obligated to drink on Purim until one cannot tell the difference between Haman and Mordechai. So Abigail Adams, as was her wont, was just observing Jewish law in proper fashion. But the most interesting references to Purim are related to Lincoln. As Aaron Zelensky notes in an interesting article, which I'm quoting from and drawing on June 12, 1848, Lincoln detailed how the Whigs' nomination of Zachary Taylor would hurt their rivals, the Democrats, and he writes, quote, the war is now to them the gallows of Haman, which they built for us, and on which they are doomed to be hanged themselves. And 7 years later, Lincoln wrote to Joshua Speed, his old friend, about Kansas's constitution, which the constitution actually allowed, quote, authorities to, quote, hang men who shall venture to inform a Negro of his freedom. That's the quote from the constitution. And Lincoln remarked that, quote, if, like Haman, they should hang upon the gallows of their own building, I shall not be among the mourners of their fate, end quote. This is Lincoln. And it's a good reminder, I'll ask everyone to please silence their cell phones. So Lincoln knew the story, and he knew it well, and he actually applied it to the moral and political quandaries of his age. It is all the more fascinating, then, to consider a case in which others made an argument to Lincoln from the Book of Esther. On September 13, 1862, the Reverend W.W. Patton, an American pastor in Chicago and a prominent abolitionist, took a contingent of clergymen to the White House and presented Lincoln with a memorandum from an assortment of Protestant ministers from Lincoln's home state and my home state of Illinois. The memorandum, the petition, had one central message. It urged the president to utilize his authority as wartime commander-in-chief to issue a proclamation freeing the slaves of the South. They wrote in the petition as follows. We urge you, therefore, as the head of this Christian nation, from considerations of moral principle and as the only means of preserving the Union, to proclaim without delay national emancipation. However void of authority in this respect you might have been in time of peace, you are well aware as a statesman that the exigencies of war are the only limits of its powers, especially in a war to preserve the very life of the nation. The rebels, they wrote, have brought slavery under your control by their desperate attack upon the life of the Republic. They have created a moral, political, and military necessity which warrants the deed, and now God and a waiting world demand that the opportunity be used. And surely the fact that they have placed in our power a system which, while it exposes them, is itself the grossest wickedness, adds infinitely to the obligation to strike the blow. Then, in their words to him, the ministers proceed to deliver a Dvar Torah, citing the turning point in the Book of Esther, where Mordechai galvanizes Esther into action to seek to reverse Haman's decree. The ministers wrote to Lincoln as follows. At the time of the national, this is a quote, at the time of the national peril of the Jews under Ahasuerus, Mordechai spoke in their name to Queen Esther, who hesitated to take the step necessary to their preservation, in these solemn words, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And then the ministers concluded by saying, "And your memorialists," meaning them, "believe that in divine providence you have been called to the presidency to speak the word of justice and authority, which shall free the bondman and save the nation. Our prayer to God is that by such an act, the name of Abraham Lincoln may go down to posterity with that of George Washington as the second savior of our country," end quote. In other words, these ministers believe that they are speaking to him, to Lincoln, as Mordechai spoke to Esther. And we have to appreciate the moral power of the scriptural citation that they are offering. As we know from the Megillah, as soon as Mordechai hears of this decree, he very dramatically and defiantly and publicly protests and bewails this genocidal dictate. "Umordechai yada'at kol asher nasa, v'yikra Mordechai et begadav, v'yilbash sak v'efer, v'yetzei betoch ha'ir, v'yitzak tzaka gedula umara." Mordechai heard of this, he knew what had occurred. He went out into the midst of the city, he tore his clothes, he put on sackcloth and ashes, and wailed in the street. And we have to understand the symbolic power of what Mordechai is doing, this bold stance that he is taking. What he's basically doing is he is taking a public stand in the middle of Persia as a Jew. Many have noted that the most shocking sentence in the Megillah for those original readers at the time when the Megillah was written is the sentence, "Ish Yehudi haya b'Shushan Abira u'shmo Mordechai." There is a Jew in Persia whose name was Mordechai. This is meant to be shocking because Mordechai is, at the time, not a Jewish name. Mordechai is of pagan derivation from the Babylonian god Marduk. It's a very shocking name for a Jew to have. I always quote in this context Jackie Mason, who has a routine in which he mocks American Jews for their penchant for Gentile names. And he says something like, "They're trying to out-Gentile the Gentiles. I know a girl, her name was Crucifix Finkelstein." Mordechai HaYehudi is the equivalent of Crucifix Finkelstein. And that, of course, is why Haman originally does not even know that Mordechai is Jewish. He has to be told that Mordechai is Jewish. Ki yigidu lo asher hu Yehudi. It's not like, even though my kids have coloring books, that Mordechai is wearing a shtreimel right in the center of the Persian palace, right? He actually has taken on all the acculturations of Persia, including the very name itself. He is a person of Ahasuerus's court. And as soon as we introduce to this person, Mordechai HaYehudi, the very name demands that we ask, well, what is his true identity? Where are his true loyalties? And now Mordechai, hearing this decree, quite literally tears his courtier's clothing and is basically saying, "I am not Mordechai, man of the court. I am a Jew, and I will take this issue to the streets, and I will protest." And of course, when his cousin, the queen, Esther, hears about this, she is horrified. She asks him to put back on his Persian clothing. And Mordechai, in response, demands that she instead do what he is doing, protest, but to do it in front of the king, to storm into the throne room, and to demand justice for the Jewish people. And of course, Esther hesitates and says, "I'm not allowed to go in to see the king without permission. I could be killed for the offense. I haven't seen him for a month." And the response of Mordechai is what was cited by the Christian clergyman to Lincoln. "Al tnami b'nafsheich limalei beit hamelech mikol hayudim ki im hacharesh tacharishi b'ayit hazot revach v'hatzalah yamod hayudim b'makom acher." Salvation will come to the Jews. The question is, what will be your place in this story? As Rav Aaron Lichtenstein has noted, this is a very emotional assault on Esther. As he writes, "Mordechai does not attribute her response to weakness. He pushes his assault to Esther all the way, appealing to the deepest recesses of the Jewish soul. He accuses Esther of refusing to see the king, not because she lacks courage, not out of weakness, but rather as a calculated choice, which is, let the entire Jewish nation be destroyed. Let them all perish. I will remain secure in the royal palace." This, says Rav Lichtenstein, is how Mordechai interprets her response. And this is what he addresses. Not weakness, not a lack of courage, but rather apathy. He's saying to her, if you really cared, if you considered your own soul to be at stake, would you be able to say, "For a whole month I haven't been to see the king"? Is this how someone talks when she believes that her nation is in danger? Is this the response of someone who cares? Mordechai, in other words, is saying, don't compromise. One must be prepared for self-sacrifice, taking care that not personal interests, but rather national, Jewish interests, will dictate one's plans and actions. Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. That's what Rav Lichtenstein says. And so this is what the ministers are citing. And this is the allegory, the parallel, that the ministers, these abolitionists, are establishing to Lincoln. It's an accusation to Lincoln, sourced in scripture. They are saying, we are Mordechai. We've been protesting slavery in the streets our entire careers. You've risen to power in the newly founded Republican Party with an anti-slavery platform. Now the slaveholding South has rebelled. Now you have wartime powers to end slavery, and you have not acted. By citing Mordechai, they are subtly suggesting that Lincoln's anti-slavery posture, Lincoln's anti-slavery position was just a posture, that deep down he was apathetic, that he didn't care. This was the message the ministers delivered to Lincoln on September 13th, 1862. It was only several days later, on September 22nd, that Lincoln issued his proclamation, the Emancipation Proclamation, to go in effect on January 1st, that slaves in rebel states would be henceforth forever free. And so it would seem that the minister's message hit home, and the scriptural citation, their Dvar Torah, had its desired effect. But the truth is, for those who know about Lincoln, the truth is that the Emancipation Proclamation had already been sitting for a drawer, the draft, in Lincoln's drawer for many weeks. Lincoln just didn't issue it because he knew that short of a battlefield victory in the war, it would have had no effect. It was only after the Battle of Antietam, which occurred 4 days after this meeting with the ministers, only after the Union achieved not a great victory, but some semblance of victory, that Lincoln said, quote, I think the time has come now. The action of the army against the rebels has not been quite what I should have best liked, but they have been driven out of Maryland, and Pennsylvania is no longer in danger of invasion. Of course, the rebel army would come back to Pennsylvania, but that's a separate point. Moreover, so Lincoln had been planning this, but he was looking for the opportunity. Because if he had issued it without any success, it would have been seen as a sign of weakness and would have had no effect. Moreover, even as we admire the Emancipation Proclamation as a bold moral statement of moral principle, the proclamation, when issued, did not free slaves in the border states that had not rebelled. Kentucky, Maryland, Missouri. For as Lincoln said, in this war, I dearly want the Lord Almighty on my side, but I must have Kentucky on my side. And so Lincoln knew that only in preserving the Union could slavery ultimately be abolished. Lincoln, no less than the ministers, wanted slavery to die out. But he understood that just boldly embracing a moral ideal publicly would not actually accomplish what people wanted to accomplish. It would not actually end slavery. That it could only be achieved, to use a Jewish term, with seichel, even if it meant not outwardly embracing the full-on abolitionist cause. And this is a larger point about Lincoln and leadership that is important to stress. It is Lincoln's complexities, his balance of the real and the ideal, his willingness to accept what was less than ideal in order to achieve the real, that was actually the true essence of his greatness. As Eric Foner once put it, the hallmark of Lincoln's greatness was his combination of bedrock principle with open-mindedness and capacity for growth. And this is something that is easy to miss. The legend of Lincoln lies in the extremes. He's either the man who fought the Civil War to free the slaves, or he's the man who mercifully forgave those who rebelled against him, as he said in the second inaugural, with malice toward none. That's how people usually speak about Lincoln, in extremes. My favorite story about Lincoln comes from Tolstoy, who describes how he was once traveling in the far-off Caucasus in Asia, and he was the guest of a tribe that had almost no contact with civilization. And so he's telling them different stories about European history. And then the chief of this Caucasus, again, who had no contact with the outside world, says to Tolstoy, wait a minute. He calls over all his friends and he says, you have not told us a syllable about the greatest general and ruler of the world. He was a hero. He spoke with a voice of thunder. He laughed like the sunrise, and his deeds were as strong as the rock and sweet as the fragrance of roses. The angels appeared to his mother and predicted that the son that she would conceive would become the greatest the stars had ever seen. He was so great that he even forgave the crimes of his greatest enemies and shook brotherly hands with those who had plotted against his life. His name was Lincoln, and the country in which he lived is called America, which is so far away that if a youth should journey to reach it, he would be an old man when he arrived. Tell us about this man. "Yes, tell us, please, and we will present you with the best horse of our stock," shouted the others. And Tolstoy said, "I looked at them and saw their faces all aglow, their eyes burning. I saw that those rude barbarians were really interested in a man whose name and deeds had already become a legend. They asked me 10 questions, to one which I was able to answer. They wanted to know about his habits, his influence upon the people, his physical strength. But they were astonished to hear that Lincoln made a sorry figure on a horse and that he lived such a simple life." Even Tolstoy himself, by the way, in citing this story, citing it to show Lincoln's greatness, actually said the following: "Of all the great national heroes and statesmen of history, Lincoln is the only real giant. Lincoln was a man of whom a nation has a right to be proud. He was a Christ in miniature, a saint of humanity, whose name will live thousands of years in the legends of future generations." But the truth is, Lincoln was a good man, but he was also a great man. And he was great in part because he was not a saint, because he had ambition, and because he had political cunning, and because he had a sense of how to achieve the real while keeping the ideal still in focus. To speak as Tolstoy does, and certainly as many speak today, is to fundamentally misunderstand Lincoln's genius and to misunderstand the essence of a truly great and successful political leader. Had Lincoln been a saint, he would have been a great American moral figure, but he would not have been the most successful president in American history. As my friend and Rabbi Ganach's friend, with whom I was privileged to co-teach a course for the Strauss Center on Lincoln and Leadership, Harold Holzer, the great Lincoln scholar, once put it, quote, he said, "For years, historians oversimplified Lincoln as the man who freed the slaves. Then after the civil rights movement a century later, the pendulum swung to a sharp degree so that some now question Lincoln's sincerity as a progressive freedom fighter. Both extremes are ridiculous. It is true that Lincoln was not the most liberal rights activist in America of his time. Frederick Douglass was more so, of course. But Lincoln was the electable one who exercised his power to destroy slavery. As for equal rights, he was a gradualist, which is why he was able to win national elections in an innately cautious and deeply racist country. We owe it to Lincoln to judge his achievements and sacrifices by the standards of his century, not ours." So the lesson of his life is that for great leaders, a sweeping moral vision is necessary, but not sufficient. What is also required is the wisdom, the intuition, and the statecraft needed to proceed in a way that these goals can be attained. And rightly understood, in a different context, that ultimately is the lesson of the book of Esther. It is Mordechai in this speech the minister cited who galvanized Esther into action. But the truth is, of course, as soon as she's galvanized into action, she does not follow his plan. She does not do at all what Mordechai wants her to do. His plan was to storm immediately into her husband's throne room and demand that the Jews be speared. This would have ended with Esther's immediate and certain death. Instead, that's ancient throne rooms didn't work that way. You just storm in and say, "I demand that you do this." It's amazing that Mordechai is even suggesting it. We'll come back to that in a minute. Instead, what Esther does, as we know, and I won't recount the whole story because, spoiler alert, I don't want to ruin it for tomorrow. Instead, she lays an elaborate strategy over several days, playing on the insecurities of a paranoid king. And then at the right moment, as it were at her Antietam, she seizes the opportunity, and her political play results in the death and downfall of Haman and the salvation of the Jews. Mordechai sparks the fire, but Esther achieves everything else with her own strategy and with her own approach. Rav Soloveitchik, in his commentary on Esther, put it this way. If we glance through the Megillah, he says, we will note that there was a disagreement between Mordechai and Esther concerning the proper course of action. Mordechai held the view that immediate spontaneous action on the part of Esther is inevitable. Esther should appear before the king, taking the risk of being rejected and executed, and plead with him hysterically to spare her people. Esther, writes Rav Soloveitchik, did not concur with Mordechai. Esther, with her incisive intelligence, he writes, understood that no plea addressed to the king would produce any results. Hysterical crying, supplication, begging would at best be ineffectual. At worst, they would cause more harm. Since Haman had succeeded in brainwashing Ahasuerus and arousing in him paranoid, mortal fear of assassins and rebels, there was no power in the world that would be capable of dissuading Ahasuerus from destroying all his imaginary enemies. Could anyone, said Rav Soloveitchik, sway Stalin from his mad designs? He exterminated hundreds of thousands who were involved in an imaginary plot. The same was true of Ivan the Terrible, Peter the Great, and Philip II of Spain. The former two of these executed their own sons. Teaching a paranoid mind is an absurdity. Esther could avail herself of one method only, said our Soloveitchik, namely to turn the tables on Haman, to accuse him of plotting against the king and the empire, to arouse doubts in the sick king's mind concerning Haman's loyalty and devotion. And Esther, writes Rav Soloveitchik, Esther succeeded. A young, frail maiden defeated the most powerful prime minister in the annals of Persia. The charismatic young woman upon whom God placed the burden, saved a people. This woman emerged victorious. Yes, he writes, Mordechai was the initiator, the teacher, the first messenger. He awakened her. He fired her imagination and sensitized her heart. Through him came the inspired words to her. Yet the strategy was hers. The critical decisions how and when to do it were hers. She could not consult Mordechai, says Rav Soloveitchik. And even if she could, she would not have accepted advice from him. End quote. Understood this way, the Megillah, the Book of Esther, is, like American history, a story that contains lessons for leaders and all of us today about the very nature of leadership. In the extraordinary Steven Spielberg movie, Lincoln, there is an amazing quote, which when I heard it in the movie, I was praying that Lincoln actually said it, because the person who wrote the script is not one of my favorite people. Unfortunately, I should have left it in the rabbinic realms of what we rabbis call too good to check, but unfortunately, while many of the quotes were indeed said by Lincoln, this was not. Nevertheless, it does capture what Lincoln said. Lincoln is speaking to the hardcore Republicans in Congress who want to just go full on for full equality immediately. And he says, Lincoln, played by Daniel Day-Lewis, says the following. He says, a compass I learned when I was surveying. It'll point you true north from where you're standing. But it's got no advice about the swamps and deserts and chasms that you'll encounter along the way. If in pursuit of your destination, you plunge ahead heedless of obstacles and achieve nothing more than to sink in a swamp, what's the use of knowing true north? End quote. Yeah, it's good, right? Unfortunately, Lincoln didn't say it. What are you going to do? Okay? Mordechai is the one in the story who stresses the true north. But once Esther is pointed to true north, she's the only one who truly surveys the political scene, who knows how to get where they need to go without falling into pits and political pitfalls along the way. So if this is the case, we have to ask a basic question. Did not Mordechai understand this? How could he not see that what he was proposing, storming into the throne room and protesting Haman's decree, could he not see that this was folly? Who comes up with a plan like this? How could he even consider it? This is not a democracy. You just walk in and say, I don't like this. Ronald Reagan used to tell a joke in which he's talking to Gorbachev, and he says to Gorbachev, you know, what's great about America is that any American can walk into the Oval Office, he can bang his hand on the desk and say, I don't like the way Ronald Reagan is running the country. So Gorbachev says, oh, they could do that in Russia. He says, what do you mean? Of course they can. He says, sure they can. They can come straight to Moscow. They can walk straight into the Kremlin. They can come straight into my office. They can bang their hands on my desk, and they can say, I don't like the way Ronald Reagan is running his country. Okay. So what did Mordechai think? This is America? Esther can walk in and say, I don't like the way Ahasuerus is running this country? What's going to happen to her? It's crazy. How could he come up with this? So here I think we can suggest something new. And it points to a fundamental point about the Megillah, something we miss. This is something I have not seen suggested anywhere, but it does draw on Rav Soloveitchik's commentary. And it's a suggestion that gets to the radical nature of the book that we are reading tomorrow night and the radical nature of the moves that Esther makes. Rav Soloveitchik has stressed that Esther is one of the very few books of the Bible that was written after the age of prophecy or at the turning point, when the age of prophecy was ending. Soloveitchik writes as follows, quote, the Megillah contains a story of events that occurred in the twilight hour of Jewish history. It marks the passing of a bright, beautiful summer day full of sun, color, and joy, a day on which God's word was on many tongues and his spirit in many hearts. It ushers in a dark, dreary, autumnal night of silence and fear, a night in the course of which God stopped speaking to his people. At that time, the covenantal community was losing, slowly but surely, the most precious gifts of all, prophecy, the great covenantal dialogue between man and God that had commenced with Abraham was about to be terminated, and the prophetic community faced a stark, ruthless reality, a non-prophetic existence. With the transition from a prophetic community to a non-prophetic community, the Jewish historical experience changed completely, end quote. So building on this, I would suggest the following. In earlier books of the Tanakh, aside from kings themselves, the central actors on the political stage are prophets. At times they are the leaders, Yoshua, Shmuel, and at times more often they are engaging the public square with the leaders or taking on the leaders, Eliyahu, Elisha, Isaiah, Jeremiah. From a political and philosophical perspective, on the scriptural scene, what is the job of a prophet? The prophet knows none of these Lincolnian complexities. They are there to deliver the moral and religious message, come what may. God takes care of the rest. If Ahav, the wicked king of Israel, murders and steals an Israelite's land, it may not be politically prudent for a subject of this king to storm into the throne room and tell him what he did was wrong. But that does not stop Eliyahu, Elijah, who has no compunctions and does exactly what Mordechai wanted Esther to do. He storms into the throne room and says, Haratzachta v'gam yarashta, will you murder and inherit as well? Natan HaNavi, Nathan the prophet, is well aware that King David, Lahavdil from Ahav, has just gotten rid of Bathsheba's husband by sending him to the front. And he knows that the king could very well get rid of him too. And yet his job is to show up in David's throne room and pronounce, Atah Ha'ish, you are the man that did this. And most importantly for our discussion, Yirmiyahu Jeremiah at the end of the first temple period knows that he may well be thrown into the dungeon, as he was, for pronouncing his proclamations to the last kings of Judah. But pronouncing them, nevertheless, he does. To utilize the dialogue from the Lincoln movie, the job of the prophet, the Navi, is to proclaim true north and to always seek it without compromise. That is what he is called to do. And this, of course, is the approach that Mordechai adopts. And when we ponder the text, we are able to understand why. The only time the land of Israel is referenced in Esther is in Mordechai's biography. Who is Mordechai? He is son of Kish, Asher hagla miYerushalayim im hagola asher haglata im Yechoniah melech Yehuda, who was exiled from Jerusalem with the exile of Yechoniah, king of Yehuda, that the king of Babylonia, Nebuchadnezzar, had exiled. This means that either Mordechai or at least his father Kish experienced the end of the kingdom of Judea, of the end of the first temple period, of the age of Jeremiah and Huldah and other prophets. This was the model of political action, in other words, that his father experienced. This was the model of political action that he had imbibed Mordechai from birth. This was the model of leadership that was part of his patrimony. If his father had been exiled by Nebuchadnezzar, if his father had been among the elites exiled with the Judean king Yechoniah, then his father was almost certainly an intimate of these prophets. And in Babylonia, he would have known Ezekiel and Daniel, who also fearlessly proclaimed their prophecies and did so in the streets and courts of pagan kings. So this was the model Mordechai knew. But what of Esther? Esther, we are told, was an orphan, Mordechai's first cousin who lost her parents as a child. Unlike Mordechai, Esther knew none of the generations of Judea intimately, of the age when prophets stormed royal courts with the words, Ko amar Hashem, thus saith the Lord. And perhaps the Megillah tells us of their respective biographies to lend a deeper dimension to their perspectives. Mordechai seeks to act as a prophetic figure. Like Isaiah, he storms the streets of Shushan, and he tells Esther to act as Eliyahu, Elijah, or Nathan, Yirmiyahu, would have done, to storm in and say, Thus saith the Lord, I don't like the way you're running this country. And Esther says, That is not that situation. This is not the way to deal with this. Or as Rabbi Soloveitchik put it, quote, the Torah tells us the story of the prophetic community at the hour of triumph, meaning most of Tanakh, at the hour of revelation. But Esther of Soloveitchik says faced a new question. What kind of message does the Torah have for the non-prophetic community at an hour of distress? Where is there in the Torah an allusion to the silent, mute confrontation between mighty historical events and the Jew in the diaspora, between a cruel monster and a lonely Jewish maiden on whose frail shoulders Providence placed the heavy load of historical responsibility. How can the Jew triumph over his adversaries and enemies if God has stopped speaking to him, if the cryptic messages he receives remain unintelligible and incomprehensible? End quote. This is the challenge Esther faces. This is the challenge Esther understands. The age of prophecy is coming to an end. A new approach to politics, to safeguarding the Jewish people in a hostile environment, needs to be adopted while retaining the faith and loyalty of the past and to the past. Esther still wishes all Israelites to gather in fasting and in prayer. She still seeks divine salvation, but her actions are performed with intuition, with intrigue, playing on the king's emotions, balancing the power structures at court, an approach that acknowledges that the age of prophecy is fading into the past, that new methods are required. Read this way, Esther is more than a heroine in this story. She becomes the first example of statesmanship in Jewish history. If by statesmanship we mean the art of acting in the public sphere without being informed what to do directly by God, if we are talking about what Isaiah Berlin called political judgment, which, as he argues, is not a science, but an art. Esther may have been the first of these examples for our prophecy-less age, the first genuine genius in leadership for that new era. And that, in part, is what we will be celebrating one day from now. If you truly wish to understand the nervousness and then the joy and exultation of the Jews in Shushan, when they finally get the news from the riders of the king that a new decree has been issued and that Haman is dead, you can read of the experience of the abolitionists as they waited on January 1st in Boston for a telegraph to see if Lincoln would make good on his word and actually free the slaves. Frederick Douglass gathered with abolitionists in Boston, and he describes the following in his memoir. He writes, quote, "The occasion wherefore was one of both hope and fear. Whether we should survive or perish depended in large measure upon the coming of this proclamation. We were waiting and listening as for a bolt from the sky which should rend the fetters of 4 million of slaves. We were watching, as it were, by the dim lights of the stars for the dawn of a new day. We were longing for the answer to the agonizing prayers of centuries." And because that's what Douglass writes, and because it is the central part of my academic activities to ensure that Jews get credits for everything, I'm delighted to report that the telegrapher who sent out the news on January 1st was a Jew by the name of Edward Rosewater, an immigrant from Germany who had actually worked as a telegrapher sending news, who had been at Jefferson Davis's inauguration in Alabama reporting, and then got a job in the telegraph office in Washington. We are everywhere. Hamilton, Edward Rosewater, everywhere. And it was he, Lincoln, actually, if you read about it, they were all waiting for him to do it first thing on January 1st. But he took his time, and he shook hands at a White House New Year's party. And then, when he came to sign the Declaration, the Emancipation Proclamation, he said that he had to wait because his hand was weakened by all the handshaking, and he didn't want anyone to think that his hand was trembling out of nervousness when he signed this proclamation. Signed it, was brought to Edward Rosewater, Zecher Tzadik V'Kadosh Livracha, and it was sent out. And when it was received, as Douglass himself says, "It was one of the most thrilling occasions I ever witnessed, the celebration, and a worthy celebration on the first step of the first step on the part of the nation in its departure from the thraldom of the ages." That's what the Jews were experiencing when they were waiting, in Douglass's words, to find out whether we should survive or perish, and it depended in large measure upon the coming of that proclamation. And then they heard the proclamation, and La Yehudim Haita Ora V'Simcha V'Sason V'Ikar. The Emancipation Proclamation is indeed an incredible moment in American history, and an answer to the prayers of the abolitionists who months before had presented Lincoln with a petition and a Dvar Torah based on the Book of Esther. It is a moment celebrated today in American history. But what we often fail to celebrate is not only the historic achievement, not only the January 1st, but the leadership and the understanding, the statesmanship and the patience and the intrigue, the willing to tolerate the real rather than the ideal, that got a country and a leader to the ultimate goal. In the end, this is what we celebrate about Esther as well, a woman who understood that the age of prophecy was passing and that a new form of genius was required to shepherd the Jewish people through crisis. This is what brought, to paraphrase Douglas, the Jewish bolt of lightning of La'yehudim haita ura v'simcha v'sason v'ikar. It is this understanding, this radical new approach, that earns Esther her place in Jewish history and eternity. And the truth is that some of the greatest and most formative figures in Jewish history are the ones who understand that another age is beginning and that a new strategy has to be adopted that is both loyal to the past but sensitive to new realities. Esther was one such person, and there are others. There is Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who lived at the time of the temple's destruction and set up a form of synagogue-based Judaism that remembered the Beit HaMikdash in all its forms, that mourned for the Mikdash, that longed for its return, but nevertheless allowed Judaism to continue without the temple. There is Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who understood that in the time in which he found himself, the oral transmission of the law was not enough for Judaism to survive, and it finally had to be written. There is Rabbi Yosef Karo, who understood that in the exile a new code was needed that would bind together and unite all of Klal Yisrael. The essence of the sometimes true genius is emphasized in cases such as Esther, where one understands that a new reality has presented itself, and you have to bridge with love and with loyalty all of the faith of the past with the exigencies of the present. And of course, one may well say that such a visionary is the man whose legacy we mark tonight, who bridged the world of the Jewish world of Europe and the new world of American Jewry, who actually rose to leadership, like Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, at a moment of Churban, who came to America and who led American Jewry with such incredible wisdom and with such incredible foresight. May Rabbi Soloveitchik's memory be a blessing, and may his wisdom and his insights enhance our own study of the Megillah, this book that was written thousands of years ago, but whose spiritual and political genius speaks to us profoundly today. Thank you very much.